Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th of November. This hour, November 8th, marked the 50th anniversary of the election of John Fitzgerald Kennedy as President of the United States.
We know that our opponents will invoke the name of Abraham Lincoln on behalf of their candidate, despite the fact that his political career has often seemed to show charity towards none and malice for all.
John Kennedy accepting the Democratic nomination in 1960, and of course 2011 will mark the 50th anniversary of the presidency of John F. Kennedy. We remember this man, and we will probably continue to remember this man for a long, long time. He has achieved, and his family has achieved, almost mythic proportions. We'll talk about why. We'll look at the significant issues during his administration, the war in Vietnam, the Cuban Missile Crisis, his becoming the first Catholic president, and how large an issue that was, how he put it to rest, actually, in the 1960 campaign. We'll look at the family, which, of course, was enormously important in his development as a politician, as a person, and ultimately as president, and then his family, and on it goes. We are fortunate to have two wonderful guests with us this hour, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Robert Dalek is here. Robert has been with us many times before. I was rereading last night his book, which is one of the best, I think, on Kennedy. It's An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963, which he spent 5 years writing, and is a very fair, thorough portrait of John Kennedy. Also, and he has a new book out. We have to book him to talk about his new book at some point, The Lost Peace, Leadership in a Time of Horror and Hope. And he has been a professor at many places, distinguished universities in the country. Robert Dalek, thank you so much for being with us. I look forward to this hour.
My pleasure.
Also joining us is Tom Putnam, and Tom is director of the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum, and they're going to be doing all kinds of things to mark the 50th anniversary of the presidency. Bob has an interesting job. He is responsible for the library's core function of collecting, preserving, and making available all the documents, the audiovisual material, and memorabilia of Kennedy and his administration. He first joined the library in 1999 as director of education, and he is a history teacher, former history teacher to high school students. He also worked for the Upward Bound program in Maine and Connecticut, assisting low-income high school students to be the first in their families to attend college. Thank you. And he'll talk about all that's going on at the library. Thank you so much for joining us for some of the program, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I have my own little library here today. It's no secret. I've told people on the air before that my family were big Kennedy supporters because it was Irish Catholic. They were strong Democrats. And so I have on today my Aunt Margaret O'Leary, God bless her, who loved John Kennedy, has this silver dollar that she had sort of this gold thing put over it. And it's now on a necklace that's covered with rhinestones, which I have worn in honor of this this interview today. It's really quite something. A lot of people loved this man.
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting. We have a lovely piece that we display in our museum that Jacqueline Kennedy had made for Douglas Dillon. He was the Secretary of the Treasury during the Kennedy years. He was actually a Republican who Kennedy wanted to have a bipartisan cabinet. But Mrs. Kennedy had this lovely piece made, and it's kind of actually a gold version of the Kennedy half dollar on a piece of quartz, and then later Mrs. Dillon, after Mr. Dillon passed away, gave it to the library so we could display it here.
Oh, very nice. Let me ask you, Robert, what is it about this man? You wrote a wonderful book about him, and there was a lot that took place in a relatively short time of his presidency, but what preceded his presidency is almost equally as compelling. The story of the family and the Irish leaving and the Catholicism and the father and the mother and the kids. It's just, we are just endlessly absorbed by this.
Yes, without question. In fact, the Kennedys are really America's royal family. And, you know, now that Ted has passed away and his son is leaving Congress, it really, in a sense, leaves a void on the American political landscape, because the Kennedys have been such an important presence in the minds of Americans, really going back to the 1920s and 30s when the founding father, as he was called, Joe Kennedy, came on the scene as a hugely successful businessman and one of the richest men in America. And then, of course, the storied family arose, the daughter of the mayor of Boston and nine children that they had. They've just been so much a part of the country's imagination for so long. And there's a kind of affection for the family. And it's not just the fact, though, of course, this is important, too, that John Kennedy was assassinated and his younger brother, Robert, assassinated in 1968. Many, many people, including myself, believe he would have become president as well. So it's a story of triumph and tragedy, and an enduring love affair between the public and the family.
And how does the museum deal with that struggle between triumph and tragedy? How do you put on display those things that were so enormous, that were so terrible, and were so grand, Tom?
Well, we try to do our best to use the artifacts, the documents, the photos that are part of our collections to tell the story in as vivid a way as we can. I'll be honest, we focus less on the tragedy and more on the triumph, but certainly, you know, the earlier tragedies that Mr. Dalek didn't refer to, but the loss of his older brother in World War II and his older sister. I mean, he knew about the loss of life. He knew what war could do to not only a country but to a family, and that certainly informed his presidency. So we try to tell the full story, but we focus especially, we're a presidential library, on those presidential years. So we have a few exhibits about his early life. We certainly tell the story of the PT-109, and one of the things that students who come here are most fascinated with is we have the coconut shell that was actually you know, the piece that helped to save his life, that he you know, carved a message and gave to some natives that he and his crew were given up for loss. And so students absolutely love to see that coconut shell and think, you know, what might have happened had he not been saved when he was on that island.
And would you please, there will be some people who don't know that story at all, because it was more than 50 years ago, certainly, that happened. Can you explain the PT story, please?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, these small torpedo boats during World War II. He was in the Solomon Islands, and they were just made out of plywood, and it was a very, very dark evening, and they were hoping to you know, take some fire onto these huge Japanese destroyers that were fueling you know, the Japanese army. And so in the middle of the night, his boat crashed into one of these larger Japanese boats, and obviously it exploded. He lost some of his crew, but he was able to swim ashore with some of his other crewmen. One of the most gripping images is he actually took in his teeth the life preserver of one of his fellow crewmen who was not a good swimmer. Anyway, it was a many days ordeal of swimming to different islands, and again, the U.S. Navy had given up. They saw the huge explosion, and they just assumed that they had all been lost. But Kennedy, eventually, there were some natives who were friendly to the American side who came by in a canoe. And so he took a coconut shell and carved native nose position, 11 alive, neat small boat, Kennedy. They actually gave it to an Australian who was working, obviously, on the American side, who then delivered the coconut shell to the U.S. Navy. And with the help of those natives, they returned to that island.
Story.
Kennedy and his crew.
You include this in the early part of your book too, Professor Dalek, along with a great deal of information about his various infirmities. This was a big thing for him to do, to swim as hard as he had to and as long as he had to, considering the fact that he wasn't all that healthy.
Oh, absolutely. was amazing how he was able to be so resilient and with the burden of the health problems he had. As a boy, he had something called spastic colitis, and he was at the Mayo Clinic where his family sent him, and they didn't have any cure or any real treatment for that disease at the time. And they finally, when they developed steroids, which became available in 1937, and it was a kind of exotic drug at the time, but his father, being as wealthy as he was, could afford to buy them. And the trouble was that they didn't know how to dose. And so they gave him, sort of overdosed him. And it did rein in his colitis, but it helped to trigger his Addison's disease, which is a malfunctioning of the adrenal glands, and also the back problems he had. It's always been thought that this was the product of some football injury that he had, but in fact, the doctors I worked with on the material tell me that he had bone deterioration in his back, in the lower lumbar, the lumbar spine, because of the effects of the steroids. So, you know, when he was on that PT boat, those boats rode very rough in the water. It was a kind of torturous business on his back. And how he managed to swim to that island and carry this, drag this, this shipmate along with him was really quite quite a marvel. He did get a medal for it, but still it was really quite extraordinary.
Yeah. Do you have on display, he was, when you read Robert's book, as I'm sure you have, Tom, and look at the amount of pain that he must have been in, he had an incredible spirit about him to just keep going and keep going, didn't he?
Absolutely. And, you know, we try to be, I'm a federal official here, and we try not to do as much interpretation, but just share these materials with historians like Mr. Dalek to tell the story and provide the interpretation for us. But certainly one of the features of his book, I think, that was especially interesting to the public was he was the first historian to have access to these medical records, and as he indicated, had a physician along with him to help interpret them. And really, I should let him offer the interpretation that he gave in the book, but really it's a courageous story of a man in great pain who in many instances had to hide that pain, whether he's meeting with Khrushchev in Vienna or and really, you know, had to dig down deep and grit his teeth and get through it all. And it plagued him throughout his presidency. And it's a complicated story, but towards the end of his presidency, he was on a different regime with more exercise and back strengthening exercises that he did, and fewer of the drugs, and was actually getting healthier towards the end of his presidency than he may have been at the beginning.
Hmm. You want to comment on that, Robert?
Yeah, I mean, Tom is absolutely right. He had this orthopedic physician from New York, a man named Dr. Krause, who told him that he better get on this exercise regimen, otherwise he's going to end up in a permanently in a wheelchair. Hmm. And he had been struggling with this back pain forever, and he had injections to take care of the pain, but it only gave him temporary relief. And also what helped him greatly was sitting in hot baths, and so hot showers, and sometimes he'd take 3, 4, 5 showers in the course of a day. Hmm. But it's really was quite amazing. And, you know, people said, well, he was on so many medications, and one of the questions I knew I was going to be asked when I was doing that book was, didn't this have an impact on
sure.
his conduct of his office? And so I set the medical records, which, as Tom said, we indeed had, I set them down alongside of the deliberations during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And what you saw there was a man who dealt with this crisis without reference to his medical problems. And so there was a kind of stoicism to him, a kind of, and he wouldn't talk about his medical issues. It wasn't something that he would dwell on. And he just was really quite courageous mm-hmm. about it.
I'm always amazed, Tom, because I was alive in those years. I was young. But all that this president and all of this country was engaged in during that time. Robert mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis and the fact that this was the first Catholic president and had to deal with issues of faith, the civil rights movement, the war in Vietnam, the space race. There were so many issues, really big issues, that were stirring in this country in the early 60s.
Right. And, you know, I think that many people remember the Eisenhower years as kind of a calm period after. I mean, certainly there were crises during that time, too, that President Eisenhower handled well. But, you know, it was the post-war years and, again, people's kind of getting back and getting their lives back together. And then President Kennedy ran on the slogan of getting the country together and picking us up and launching us into the 1960s. And he took on those struggles head on. And as you indicated, there were quite a few. And also one that you didn't mention was he also faced a tough economy and a number of economic crises that he had to consider. But the as you suggested, I think the ones that we highlight in our museum are civil rights, the space race, his launching of the Peace Corps, and again, his stirring inaugural address where he tried to get the country together to say the only way that we can solve these problems is for ordinary citizens to dedicate themselves to these public concerns and public challenges.
Mm-hmm. I was listening to a lot of speeches again yesterday, and the guy had a gift, didn't he? Robert,
oh,
he really had a gift.
And, you know, we're obviously marking the passing of his colleague and speechwriter and senior counsel, Ted Sorensen, who helped write many of those speeches. But I think together they really were able to hearken back to our country's founding ideals. And many of those speeches you really can read today, and you can apply them to the challenges of our time. I think that's one of the reasons why they have such a everlasting positive presence for all of us.
Yeah. Tell us about the issue of faith. I was listening to his acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention, Robert, and I had forgotten how he took the issue of Catholicism on right then and there.
Yes, he, of course, was dogged by that during the 1960 campaign, because what's so hard for us to, I still teach university students, and of course they couldn't imagine that anyone would care nowadays if someone were a Catholic running for president. And of course it's because of Kennedy's success in the White House that this issue has been totally eclipsed or tossed aside, and also it opened the way, I think, for Barack Obama, a African-American, to win the White House. So it was a terrible issue at the time, and there was a lot of bias against Catholics, and there was all this talk that if a Catholic became president, he'd be beholden to the Pope in Rome. And Kennedy confronted this head-on in September of 1960 in a speech he gave to a group of Protestant ministers at a hotel in Houston, Texas. And he was really quite forthright about it, and in essence said, I happen to be a Catholic, but, you know, I'm an American, I'm a Democrat. He spoke about his service to the country. He would mention the fact that nobody asked his brother, when he went on what turned out to be a suicide mission, what his religion was. Nobody asked him what his religion was when his PT boat was cut in half by that Japanese destroyer in the Solomon Islands. So he was able to confront it very effectively. Now, this is not to say that it didn't remain something of an issue, because when I looked at the voting data, I think it was amazing how close the election turned out to be, because there was a lot of feeling that he was going to end up with 52-53% of the popular vote, and he barely squeaked through. He won by about 118,000.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, very,
not many.
Close, very close. And I think a part of it was the fact that there were these lots of folks casting anti-Catholic ballots. But, you know, what helped him hugely, and he and his father understood this, was having Lyndon Johnson as his vice presidential running mate, because Johnson gave him a kind of a standing in the South. And the fact that they could win some southern states, and particularly Texas, which was Johnson's home state, was, of course, course, made all the difference in winning the election for him.
Yeah. Let's welcome a couple phone calls. Tom is with us the first half hour. Robert is here for the whole hour. So let's take a couple calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Tom Putnam is director of the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum, and Robert Dalek is a wonderful historian. He's written many, many thorough and highly acclaimed books for reference and purpose of today's show. If you haven't read An Unfinished Life, you'll want to. John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963. He also has a new book out. Tom from Madison, hi.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen. I am really enjoying this conversation, and Mr. Dalek, it is an honor to be on the other end of the phone with you. One of my fond memories from when I was growing up, and you probably know all about this, the JFK Traveling Library came to Milwaukee to the Public Art Museum. I want to say it was probably in the mid-60s, sometime around there. And I remember seeing that coconut that you were talking about earlier. It's just fantastic having a piece of history like that right in front of your face. And I also wanted to mention a great movie that I just saw on Netflix. It's called JFK, The Restless Years, with Patrick Dempsey, I believe, and he did just a great job as JFK. And they portrayed the whole PT-109 incident almost exactly the way you just explained it, about him dragging his one PT boat member in his teeth, and he had to swim to shore. It was all depicted in the movie. It was just excellent. So if anybody's interested and they want to look that up, it's called JFK, The Restless Years.
Okay.
And I saw it on Netflix.
Thank you, Tom, very much. Tom Putnam?
Well, we hope that others will come to, if you're in Boston, that people will come to our museum and, as the caller suggests, be in the presence of these actual artifacts. But we are now trying to do the next best thing, which is to create an online presence. And so we're launching a new website on the 50th anniversary of JFK's inaugural address so that people will have immediate access to over 500,000 of the pages of documents and photos and all of the video and all of the speeches. So we're digitizing all of those items and trying to create basically a virtual library and a virtual museum on the website for people who can't come to Boston.
Oh, won't that be wonderful? And what's the 50th anniversary of the inaugural? What date?
Oh, so that would be January 20th, 2011.
January 20th. And how else will you be marking the 50th anniversary of the presidency?
Well, we're having events here. We're having a conference, and actually Mr. Dalek is coming to speak at it. That's going to be on President's Day. Here, again, in Boston, it'll likely be shown on C-SPAN. And we also are working with other venues. So, for instance, on the 50th anniversary of the inaugural, there'll be an event at Capitol Hill, you know, at the exact moment where JFK gave the inaugural address. We will sit with members of Congress and listen to that address again. Caroline Kennedy and others will be there. And then that evening at the Kennedy Center, there'll be a wonderful gala to celebrate President and Mrs. Kennedy's devotion to the art. So for us, it'll be 3 years of programming. We'll do, you know, the 50th anniversary of the launching of the Peace Corps, 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides, 50th anniversary of the race to space and his famous speech to put a man on the moon. So we'll be marking it with historians and members of the Kennedy administration here at the library. Again, a lot of our events also are streamed live on our website, so your listeners could check out our website, which is www.jfklibrary.org. And even if you can't come to Boston, you can participate in that way.
And you've got some kind of tweeting campaign going on, too?
Yes, so we did that primarily for the 1960 campaign. So, as you all know, Barack Obama revolutionized presidential campaigns recently with the way he used the internet, and we tried to imagine, well, what would have been like had they had the internet in 1960. So, what we did was we used again the documents from our collection, and we gave a day by day what JFK was doing during the 1960 campaign. This was the press release. This was the speech he gave.
Oh,
this was a photo of him. So we had thousands of followers on Twitter that would watch the campaign unfold as if it was unfolding in real time. It was quite a successful venture for us.
Yeah, Tom, you're going to have a pretty busy 3 years, I think. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to see that museum sometime. Robert Dalek remains with us. He is a wonderful historian, Bancroft Prize-winning historian, author of a number of books, and we hope that you will, if you haven't read it, look at An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963. His latest book is The Lost Peace, Leadership in a Time of Horror and Hope, 1945 to 1963. Robert Dalek stays with us, and we'll take more phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Eight of my grandparents left these shores in the space almost of months and came to the United States. No country in the world, in the history of the world, has endured the hemorrhage which this island endured over a period of a few years of so many of her sons and daughters. These sons and daughters are scattered throughout the world, and they give this small island a family of millions upon millions who are scattered all over the globe, who have been among the best and most loyal citizens of the countries that they have gone to, but have also kept a special place in their memory, in many cases their ancestral memory, of this green and misty island. So in a sense, all of them who visit Ireland come home.
President John F. Kennedy's trip to Ireland. You spend a lot of time early in the book, Robert, talking about his parents trying to distance themselves from Ireland and his early trip there to see his sister, and he just kind of embraced the place. He really liked it, and oh, they loved him in 1963, didn't they?
They sure did, and it was such a special moment for the Irish, in a sense, a homecoming for him. He was on his trip to Europe, and that was the trip in which he famously said in Berlin, "Ich bin ein Berliner," and he arrived in Ireland to a hero's welcome. And, of course, it was not long after that tragically he was assassinated. And so it just heightens the, I think, the special sense that people in Ireland have about that visit.
Right. Let's talk about some of the really dangerous times that we were living through in those years. And again, I can't believe it's been 50 years, but looking at the Cuban Missile Crisis and how he handled that issue, what we gave up to make sure that the missiles were out of Cuba, what we gave up in Turkey, and how he maneuvered the situation. Did he keep us, do you think, from World War III?
I think unquestionably so. You know, he was someone who had been badly stung by the failure at the Bay of Pigs. That was the invasion of Cuba in April of 1961 by Cuban exiles, which was sponsored, supported by the CIA. And it was a project left over from the Eisenhower administration, and Kennedy was dubious. He was skeptical. Remember, he had given a speech about the Alliance for Progress, and he wanted to, in a sense, reignite Franklin Roosevelt's good neighbor policy and reestablish a kind of warm connection between the United States and the Southern republics. And sponsoring this invasion of Cuba, it was going to be transparent to everyone that it was originated in the United States. And it failed miserably, of course, and Castro captured most of the invaders. Over 100 of them were killed, and Kennedy was chagrined by it. And he walked around for days after that, saying, "How could I have been so stupid?" Hmm. And he was very pained by the fact that he had been given what he felt was very poor advice by his by the CIA and by national security advisors. And so, when you got to the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962, he had great doubts about the kinds of things his advisors were telling him, particularly his military advisors, who were urging him to bomb and invade the island. And he just didn't want to do it. And, of course, what we know now from the materials that have come to hand since was that the Soviets had these intermediate and short-range missiles, and some of them were ready to go. And if we had bombed and invaded, it's entirely possible that they would have launched these weapons against, Florida, something like that. Because the intermediate weapons could, I think, had a range of some 1,500 miles. And so it's entirely possible that we would have ended up in a nuclear exchange with the Soviets, and all that would have meant for the devastation of both sides, and particularly of civilization in general. So, you know, it was heroic of him to resist the military suggestions. He tried diplomacy. The quarantine, as it was called, was really a blockade, and Khrushchev and the Soviets had the wisdom to back away from a confrontation, and he emerged from that crisis with a halo around his head as someone who had done brilliantly. And, you know, Kathleen, I'm convinced that his success in that Cuban Missile Crisis to this day resonates in the sense that what it told people was, see, you had a Catholic as president, and he was brilliantly effective in defending the well-being of the country.
Hmm.
See, and I think it went very far to disarm the kind of antagonism that people who voted against him, a lot of people who voted against him in 1960 felt.
Hmm. Let's go to Richard from Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Please forgive me if I can't join in the hagiography and the Camelot myth, but what sticks in my mind is the fact that, like Eisenhower, Johnson, and Nixon, he lied to the American people about the Vietnam War. He had a head of state removed, that is assassinated, that is Ngo Diem. I think the romance of the Cuban Missile Crisis is a little bit overblown when you think that a good part of that crisis had to do with the Russian desire to get rid of our missiles on its border. Then there was Black Ops operations, the continuous Black Ops operations to assassinate Fidel Castro, which were comical. And what is even more depressing in a social sense is the fact that he was sleeping around with Marilyn Monroe, Judith Exner, and the Mafia, and I understand even an East German intelligence agent. Now, to me, that is quite a record for three short years.
Robert.
Well, I guess it's the old proposition, is the glass half empty or is it half full?
Mm-hmm.
Because what the gentleman is describing, of course, there's elements of truth to this. There's no question that the Cuban Missile Crisis was partly the consequence of the Black Ops operation, and it was also the consequence of the fact that the Soviets were very much, there was a missile gap, but it favored us, and they were very anxious to try and close that gap by putting these missiles into Cuba so that they could strike at the United States. We had submarine missiles, which gave us a huge advantage. It's also true that Kennedy signed off on the assassination of Diem in Vietnam. He certainly did not sign off on the assassination, and he was terribly chagrined by that.
So, you know, what one has to do is balance these things out. And let me say a word about Vietnam here. Kennedy was skeptical about expanding that conflict in Vietnam. It's true. When he came to office, there was something like 600 American military advisors there. When he died in November of 63, there were 16,700. He had increased the number so substantially. But he was very, very skeptical about having a ground war in Vietnam. And he had already scheduled the removal of 1,000 of the advisors at the end of 1963. And he made a number of comments about how skeptical he was about the having American forces fight in Vietnam. Now, we'll never know, of course, exactly what he would have done, but I doubt very much that he would have escalated the war the way in which Lyndon Johnson did and got us into that failed effort there. As far as the womanizing goes, no question about it, although on the Marilyn Monroe thing, we don't know for certain that he had relations with Marilyn Monroe. That's not been proven, but it certainly is true that there were lots of other escapades, and indeed I documented one in my book about some 18, 19-year-old intern that he had an affair with. But on the other hand, I looked at this closely. Did it have an impact on his conduct of the office? Now, you know, one can make a moral case, I guess, about his unfaithfulness to his wife, and of course, this idealized picture of the perfect family is overdrawn. But you know, this was between him and Jacqueline, in a sense, as to what he was doing there. Now, I don't subscribe to the idea that a president of the United States should carry on the way he did, but the real question is how much impact, if any, did it have on his conduct of the office, and I'm hard-pressed to find evidence that it diminished his handling of public affairs.
The carrying on started pretty early. You started in the book with when he was a teenager, and he had a lot of sexual incidents. He was a pretty highly sexed young guy, huh?
He sure was, and he was very handsome and apparently very seductive, and women came, so to speak, at his beck and call.
One of the things that I love from your book and from listening to some of these speeches was the way that he spoke. And I know that some of that was Sorensen, but some of that was off the cuff from Kennedy. You could tell, and your book gets at this, that those things that he really cared about, he exhibited that at a very young age, that he was interested in current events. He was interested in history. He was interested in Europe and in Winston Churchill. And there are some things that he just took to heart, other things he didn't care as much about, like Latin or whatever. But he was able to speak so beautifully and to carry that concern that he had and share it with other people in a way that he made other people concerned about those issues as well.
Well, you know, I think what you're raising is a very important point, because the question historians can ask is, why is it that he has this kind of hold on the not just the public's imagination in this country, but around the world?
Right.
This book I did is in 11 foreign editions, and to this day I hear from people, you know, all over the world about their admiration, affection for John Kennedy. I think it has a great deal to do with the disillusionment, the frustration, disappointment that people feel in the presidencies of a Lyndon Johnson, of a Richard Nixon, of the recent presidency of a George W. Bush. I think what they crave is inspiration, an inspirational voice. And the two presidents that they admire most since the 1960s are Kennedy and Reagan. In fact, when you ask people in this country who are the greatest presidents in American history, predictably they tell you Washington, Lincoln, and FDR, but then they add the names of John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan. And it's kind of astonishing, because after all, Kennedy was there for only 1,000 days,
And the Reagan presidency, we don't have any significant scholarship on it yet. There's some good journalistic writing, but we're yet to get in-depth scholarship because the papers are in the process of being opened or made available. So I think it has a lot to do with the fact that these two presidents have a hold on the public because of the inspirational rhetoric, because of the speeches they made.
Yes.
And people remember Kennedy's inaugural address. They remember the speech he gave at American University in which he said, mankind must do away with war, or war will do away with mankind. They remember Reagan as the great communicator and as someone who was able to make extraordinary connections to the public. And, you know, for me, the most telling example of this is after Franklin Roosevelt died, somebody stopped Mrs. Roosevelt on the street and said to her, I miss the way your husband used to speak to me about my government. See? And this is what people crave. And I think since Roosevelt, it's Kennedy and Reagan who seem to give this to people. And, you know, one of the current knocks on President Obama is that he was brilliant in communicating a message to the public in the 2008 campaign, but that somehow this has not sustained itself. And people feel frustrated by that. So, you know, they want that sense of connection. They want that inspirational voice. And, of course, Obama's emphasis on hope is something that people continue to yearn for.
Yes. Hope dies last, right?
Yep.
Hugh in Milwaukee.
Hi. There are two points I want to make. By the way, my first vote for president was for John Kennedy, and he did carry my state. I had been involved in civil rights, and one of the people I sat in with first, we were in the first sit-in in New Orleans, was a Jerome Smith. Jerome would make news a little later when he met with Bobby and company, and he said that something to the effect, and I don't know the exact words now, but that why would he fight for the government, for the United States, when the government isn't fighting for him in Mississippi? He had gone to Mississippi to work in civil rights. Kennedy, when he appointed judges, federal judges in the South, he usually appointed the most racist judges he could think of. In New Orleans, Minor Wisdom, who was quite liberal, was appointed by Eisenhower or Truman. But Kennedy's judges, and the judges were quite important during the civil rights movement, they were usually extremely reactionary, extremely racist. Now, the other point is that Kennedy still had the image of being on the left. And I was teaching fifth grade in 63, and when I walked in and heard the news and announced to my class that John Kennedy had been shot in Dallas, they immediately erupted in cheers and applause.
Well, that's great. Mm. Yeah, Robert?
Well, that's, you know, very, very sad.
Yeah.
You know, the point the gentleman makes about Kennedy's judicial appointments is right on the mark. He was very cautious about civil rights, and he came slowly to the understanding that this was an issue which he could not keep on the back burner. He wanted to get past his $11 billion tax cut to spur the economy. He wanted to get federal aid to education through the Congress. He wanted to get Medicare passed, and he felt if he pushed civil rights to the front, he would not be able to get these other legislative measures through. Well, of course, the truth is that he couldn't get any of them through, and by 1963, with the difficulties he had in Alabama and Mississippi, and he said at one point about the Southern leaders and Southern racists, they're never going to change. And so he finally saw the light, so to speak, and he put a civil rights bill before the Congress in June of 1963. And this is largely the civil rights bill that Lyndon Johnson was able to get passed in July of 1964, which brought an end to segregation in all places of public accommodation. And so the gentleman's right. Kennedy's record on civil rights is quite mixed, But at the end of the day, he did step forward. And I think if he had lived and had been reelected, he would have won a landslide, because probably running against Goldwater, as Johnson did, he would have carried into the Congress huge majorities. And I think he then would have gotten the four major pieces of legislation passed that I mentioned. I don't think he would have done as much as Johnson did with his Great Society, although the idea for the War on Poverty had been initiated in the Kennedy presidency. But, of course, these are things we'll never know.
Yeah. Robert Dalek is our guest this hour as we mark the 50th anniversary of the election of John F. Kennedy as President of these United States. That took place on November 8, and of course there will be a lot of probably books written and ceremonies taking place marking his presidency, which is also 50 years ago, 2011. We'll take more phone calls. We'll have time for maybe a couple. And here it is, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that method of communication, is talk@wpr.org. Robert has written a number of books about many presidents. He actually has a new book out now, but because this is a 50th anniversary, we are referencing a book that he wrote in, I think it was 2003. It seems like it was 2007, but it was a little while ago. An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Robert Dalek's new book, which we will book him for to talk about down the road, The Lost Peace, Leadership in a Time of Honor and Hope, 1945 to 1953. Robert, are you going to write anything that will come out during the next 3 years dealing with the 50th anniversary?
Yeah, I think I'm, not I think I know, I'm going to do a book on the people around Kennedy. The,
oh, great.
The Kennedy advisors, and look at Ted Sorensen and Arthur Schlesinger, Robert Kennedy, of course, who was very much at the center of JFK's presidency as Attorney General and confidant, Robert McNamara and McGeorge Bundy. These were some of the principal people who were around him, and all quite an interesting cast of characters. The best and the brightest, as David Halberstam once described, though with a certain irony, of course, as to that use of that phrase. But yeah, I'm gonna do that.
Jim is next in Medford. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
Yeah, like you just mentioned before, chances are in 1964 he would have beat out Goldwater, which would have taken them to the end of 68. As far as, like you said, the Vietnam, that would have been right in the middle of the Vietnam War. Do you believe if he would have stayed in office that long that there would have been many thousands of lives saved, and he would have pulled a lot of troops out of there earlier, or do you think it would have been more similar to what Johnson had did?
No, I think he never would have put in that kind of land force. In fact, he said to Arthur Schlesinger at one point, he said, if you agree to put in these land troops, he said, it's like the man who takes a drink and the effect wears off, and then he has to take another drink and another drink. And he glimpsed the future of what Johnson faced, because Johnson in July of 65 put 100,000 ground troops into Vietnam. And then in January of 66, he signed on to putting in another 120,000. And by 1968, we had 545,000 troops in Vietnam. It was a massive force. And so I don't think Kennedy would have done that. I think he was usually skeptical about what we could do in one of these wars. And, of course, that was prophetic in the sense that we were bogged down there. It took until 1967, 68 for people in this country to really see what a morass this was.
Thank you, Jim, for the call. One more call. We're almost out of time. Julie in Elk Mound. Hi.
Hi. Hi, good morning. I was curious about something. I was around 11 years old during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and my school actually issued us little dog tags. And in my travels through the country, and I've been in different areas, I've asked people around my age if they ever heard of this, and it seemed like they hadn't. And I was just wondering if it was something that that was locally done or if it was certain cities. My hometown was Council Bluffs, Iowa, and it was just a few miles from Belden, Nebraska, which was the SAC headquarters at the time.
Whoa. Have you heard of this? We have about 10 seconds, Robert.
No, I never heard of that.
I haven't either.
I know during World War II, students were issued, IDs that you wore, never heard this during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
No, it might be somebody you want to be in touch with the museum about that. Maybe they can display it. Robert, you're always a wonderful guest. Thank you for all of your books, too. I love rereading them.
Thank you.
Robert Dalek, our guest, the book that we're referencing, An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls and listening. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversations ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.